There's no escape from the lighter side of genocide. There's no escaping Fukushima radiation either. And incidentally, we were broadcasting from nuclear-free New Zealand, from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, in the island-chained nation in the slave South Pacific. And coming at us live now from the shakiest, the rockingest city on earth, from Christchurch, it's Blair Anderson from Wild Greens. Welcome back to the show, mate. We haven't had you on for quite a while.
No. It's been about 2,000 shakes ago.
Yeah. So that would be like 20 minutes. Now, when we're talking about Christchurch, we want to talk about the politics of what's going on there right now. And I just elaborated for the listeners before the break just what transpired with Don Brash and the cannabis debate on Campbell Live last night. And you gave me a ring up this morning and you said you're actually going to stand for the ACT Party in Canterbury, which I thought was I had no idea that would ever be a possibility.
Well, whether that it happens or not is dependent on a whole lot of things happening down the chain of deck chairs, they call, you know, party political politics. But, I just thought I'd throw my hat in the ring, partly because they asked me back in 2002 to run, because then there was legitimacy around debate. And we shouldn't be surprised. ACT has had a leader in Rodney Hyde who, has been not very charismatic about the subject, certainly not as much as Don Brash. But he has said publicly and in many forums that he'd legalise all drugs tomorrow. So we shouldn't be really surprised that the Association of Consumers and Taxpayers should be looking to a lighter form of governance than the kind of draconian, right-wing model of, imported politics we call drug prohibition here.
But then again, there's a wee bit of hypocrisy there, because what about how the super city was force amalgamated and $28 billion got put into Auckland Properties Limited, and now the government's secretly selling off public housing, privatising everything. It's real strange. There's these two wings to ACT itself as a party, where one of them is draconian right-wing sort of economic policy, and the other one is full-on libertarian social policy.
It's most parties, of course, are a land of contrasts as well, and it's the test of ideas. I mean, way back in around 1998, 1999, from the floor of the Labour Party National Conference, the move to, how could I put it, at least look at drug policy and more specifically the decriminalisation of cannabis. And I say that word, the decrim word with some caution. It's like the word drugs. We really don't have ownership of what that means anymore. And the word decriminalisation and legalisation are much bandied and poorly understood and tend to obfuscate the subject. But ACT is an interesting bunch of people, and particularly they hosted a colleague of mine, Clifford Wallace Thornton Jr., who would be known to a few listeners in drug policy for his advocacy in the US of A. He's the co-chair of the Green Party in the US of A. So having the co-chair, of an organisation called Efficacy Online. You can find Clifford Wallace Thornton Jr. on the internet. But he spoke to the gathering of ACT supporters here, a full house and a restaurant here in town. And Rodney Hyde was present. Clifford's for the legal regulation, medicalisation and age of consent control of drugs. After losing his mother to heroin. And he knows that if we'd applied good policy principles then, his mother would still be alive. But just about everybody in the room agreed, except I think it was Joe Giles. And Joe Giles ran for ACT. So you can see that you can have rabid prohibitionists and a room full of legalisers, and still these ideas are you know, tested, and we can, you know, bring them to the fore in any which way. I think ACT would be a good vehicle to, you know, at least challenge John Keyes, the economist of note, who thinks he can rewrite the law of supply and demand.
Well, when we talk about drug policy, there's the two responses that you often get. There's the reasoned, rational response, which is always to decriminalise, always to legalise, because the evidence supports it, and it's basically an unwinnable argument to do the opposite thing. But then, of course, you still get the opposite response in spite of that, because they simply won't listen. They won't look at any evidence. They won't do anything to change their mind or what have you. Just very, very close-minded people, which incidentally, Bob Melamed has defined these two groups of people as blips and flips, the forward-looking people and the backward-looking people. And he's incidentally linked this to the amount of cannabinoids in their system. So so these people need to smoke more weed, man, and then they'll come right.
And you're partly right. I mean, Bob takes a genetic and biological perspective to evolution, and there are certainly people who have a more receptive view of things, and I think that on balance they're probably the healthier lot, and of course. Cannabinoids are linked to a wide range of health parameters. I think it's absolutely intrusive of the state to pretend for so long that it's got this right. And I'm encouraged by the fact that a few years ago, when Labor was still holding the balance of power, they slipped through a little bit of legislative adjustment to the Misuse of Drugs Act, specifically an amendment to the Misuse of Drugs Act in 2008. And it was done by order in council, which is significant, because when I told the select committees you could do this and, you know, do this adjustment, this crucial adjustment by order in council, it didn't need a vote in the full House. It was questioned and challenged and referred to the legal eagles that are advisers to the select committees. And they came back a couple of hours later and we re-adjourned. And the advice to the select committee was, indeed, I was right. And this was a profound change in thinking about how to get a legislative adjustment that's not riddled with the kind of perversity that we see in some of the rhetoric that's coming out of the two major parties and in response to Dr. Brash's questioning of the efficacy. And he hasn't actually said what he wants. He's merely said we should debate this, and we get all this perverse reaction. That legislative adjustment that was done was actually the order in council took place just prior to the election that saw John Key elected as Prime Minister. In fact, the standing orders require 28 days for any objection. Of course, there was an election campaign. When I got wind of this particular piece of legislation, I ducked for cover and when I say I withdrew any nomination to run for governance as an elected House member, simply because I didn't want to draw any attention to this legislation, because when I saw the quality of it, I recognised that this is the best thing that we could have ever have done in respect of a response to the vexing issues and unresolved tensions surrounding drug policy. This is called the Restricted Substances Regulations, and it can be found on the website, the official website of legislation.govt.nz. That's the home of all our regulatory and bills and so forth. And all you need to do is go into that legislation.gov.nz website and put in the phrase restricted substance regulations, and you'll find that what we did in an innovative step called by Professor Nutt, the UK former advisor and chair of their expert advisory committee, it was described by Professor Nutt as that he wished he'd thought of these regulations himself. And when I asked specifically, should we put cannabis in those regulations, his reply was an emphatic absolutely. So they have received scrutiny by at least one person, even though they were a visitor to New Zealand. They haven't received any scrutiny by any of the media commentators, bloggers, right and left wing political pundits. It hasn't been talked about by either the New Zealand Police or the National Drug Intelligence Bureau. And it hasn't been critiqued by any standing members of the House in the 2.9 years that have this has been the regulatory model mooted as the one that the whole world is watching. What this regulatory model provides for is the use of recreational psychoactive soft drugs under the aegis of the UN-compliant Misuse of Drugs Act. Now, that's an innovation in its own right. And when I proposed this as an idea or a conceptual idea when I was travelling across the United States, it opened so many doors and people saw it as such a pragmatic concept that they were keen to see such a an initiative and, you know, start in the US of A.
Would you say it not only opened doors but also opened gateways?
Well, it has in terms of the dialogue. I mean, I got to speak to mayors of Milwaukee and San Diego and Albuquerque, senators from Seattle, the Canadian Senate, the Californian and Connecticut Senates are also very interested in this. And I find it ironic that, you know, you can talk about this in New Zealand and you're largely ignored, but you travel more than 1,000 kilometres and suddenly you're regarded as an expert on legislative reform. But what I'd want to highlight is that these regulations...
It's just because you've got an accent, basically. But continue.
Yep, you're absolutely right. Because
and that happens in New Zealand too. We even had. Do you remember that guy Wilkes or whatever his name was? Complete fantasist, you know. Said he was on. He knew the Jamaican bobsled team, and he'd played rugby and all this kind of stuff. Because he had a British accent, nobody in New Zealand questioned him. This guy was completely out of his freaking mind.
And we suckered it up and the media did so too, and unquestioned.
I mean, I don't know about you, but I thought he was sexy, you know.
Well, he was at least interesting. And sometimes I think that, you know, flights of fantasy are far more interesting than reality. And as long as they don't hurt anybody, I can't see the harm. It's called fiction, and it's a multi-million-dollar business just because we write it down. What I was going to say, really, in terms of what we need to do in drug policy is to understand that we cannot rewrite the laws of supply and demand, despite what John Key and Phil Goff think. However, we can respond with a pragmatic solution, and what I'd want to highlight is that one pragmatic solution is this beautiful 5 pages PDF, of the which the first page is really the index, and the last page is the really the exciting bit called the explanatory note. Any legislation that's written requires at least some discourse of what it really means, because that's what legislation is. It's normally a very obtuse document and warrants significant explanatory note. But this is just reduced to a paragraph. And what the legislation makes provision for is not only the consideration that people do use drugs and not all drug use is misuse, but it makes provision for the R18 consistency. It places restrictions on where you can sell something. You know, you can't sell it from tents and caravans and mobile sources and so forth. You know, you've got to have a place of sale that's identifiable, much like you do with many other goods. It places restrictions on advertising, but those restrictions are constrained only insofar as they shouldn't be in your face and so forth. It doesn't restrict the advertising on the internet, for example.
Voices of reason are always very few in number, and it's usually the small, isolated voices that actually make a difference in this world. Because all of those people that just listen to the ones who drone on and on about the same old crap all day long never really accomplish anything. My guest, Blair Anderson from Christchurch, from mildgreens.blogspot.com, is one of those people. Welcome back, Blair.
Welcome, everybody. As I say, the contrast about the dialogue, and there is a legitimate dialogue about drug policy. There always will be. But the contrast, as I see it, is that those people who bang on about how dangerous a drug is and how prohibition has to work if we only try hard enough and throw more resources at it, fail to recognize that none of this has been successful, that our regulatory model, on the other hand, creates the angst and, you know, and ire that is often expressed and gets played up by media, and I must say disproportionately, because media should not report people who cannot substantiate in evidential form an argument. And, you know, that's the cross-check, but they never do it when it comes to drug policy.
Yeah. Hey, whoa, I just noticed something right there. That is brilliant policy. That, imagine if we had a media policy where you're not allowed to report people's opinions unless they're able to substantially back it up with some form of evidence. And now, can I ask you a question? Would that then void the propensity of the media to go out and do vox popula, you know, ask a convoluted question to idle people on the street? Who, like in the Campbell Live example, they went around Epsom shops with diamond salespeople and like high fashion stores and whatnot that, and talked to the customers and, do you want cannabis decriminalized? And like, no. And they all said no. And again, they gave extra plug play to the people who say, well, it destroys young people, it makes people go crazy, it causes crime, blah, 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 with absolutely no evidence to substantiate them. And they give these people a freaking spotlight. But you go out there and you say, well, actually, in 10,000 years of recorded usage, there's not one recorded death directly attributed to cannabis. That person won't make the freaking headlines, will they?
You're quite right. And on balance, media and the police have had I could express it kindly by saying it's been a self-serving relationship, and that's been no less evident over methamphetamine than it has been over cannabis. The fact that we go to the police association and ask him for his expertise in drug policy, when indeed there is no evidence that the police have curtailed use. In fact, you know, cannabis is so popular in New Zealand, it may as well be compulsory. Mm-hmm. And nobody says, well, hang on, Greg, where can you demonstrate efficacy for the funds invested? And that would put paid to that argument. But no journalist has got the balls or temerity to do so. When I speak to journalists about this sort of thing, I've had it direct from journalists, and I paraphrase the collective opinion of many of them by saying it was more than my job's worth. Now, that's a pretty disappointing representation of the Fourth Estate, and that's been no more evident than the complete failure of any media to talk about the restricted substances regulations and what they mean. The fact that we can have a policy that acknowledges place of supply and supply restrictions on advertising, labelling, packaging, signage requirements and storage and display restrictions. And that is a full and complete document written in a mere 3 pages of legislation. It is erudite. It is succinct. It is concise. And yet we wax on about whether we should have warnings on wine bottles. And we wax on seemingly perpetually on the harms of alcohol. Media play the either-or argument as if people who smoke cannabis never touch alcohol, or likewise, those who drink alcohol never touch cannabis. And yet one displaces the other. The tougher you come down on cannabis, the more you drive people to drink. The more accessible you make drink, and the more in the community by endorsing it the way we have, as we have with Stein Lager over the America's Cup or Heineken over the Rugby World Cup and so forth. And the more you vilify cannabis users, people are left with the impression, particularly young people and impressionable people, that all their peers are doing it and they can't bloody wait. Cannabis must be good if we're banning it. I mean, Class A, Class B and Class C, all the really excellent drugs must be Class A. So you get this perception that their laws are effective, but actually they're counterproductive. The experience of Portugal would not be being talked about in such glowing terms if nigh on 3 years ago we had simply put cannabis by executive council decision into the declassification schedule, sometimes referred to as Class D, called the Restricted Substances Regulations. The fact that the explanatory note to that regulation reads that it talks about creating a regime for regulating restricted substances. That what are restricted substances? They are psychoactive drugs that are considered to be of low risk, but still in need of some regulation. That's the words from the explanatory note. And when we consider that alcohol is not a drug of low risk, tobacco is not a drug of low risk, and we do have regulations that we enforce strictly around them, here is minimum purchase age of 18, prohibitions on a free-of-charge distribution scheme. That means, you know, you could give me some, I could give you some. They're basically saying free of charge distribution means I can't go out and sell it and say I'll give you some to try. That's the difference. And so communal law, friendly dealers still exist, but you can't go out and advertise, here, I'll give you some, because this is a weed that grows for a few dollars for a significant quantity of psychoactive substance. You wouldn't want free of charge distribution to aid sales.
Not to mention you wouldn't need it, would you? But as the Netherlands experiment showed, that when you legally regulate substances, the usage of them actually goes down. You know, I mean, drug dealers aren't in the habit of asking for ID these days, are they?
And despite the competition, unfettered competition, where you can walk from cafe to cafe, the price seems to stay at a fairly consistent level, and it doesn't seem to threaten particularly, the sales of Chivas Regal or any other quality, fermented liquor or distilled spirit. What that suggests is that these things find a balance. In order for people to make money out of it, it sells for a respectable price. I can't buy a decent coffee for under $4.50. And yet it's a ground-up seed. That's sold on the open market. It's one of the biggest commodities, commodity markets in the world. the revenue is really about the service delivery of, you know, give me the smell and give it to me in a nice cup and a nice place to drink it. And that's where the, you know, the tax and the GST and all that sort of stuff comes from. If we were to tax and regulate, which is the preferred kind of description in California, it might look exactly like these regulations.
The number one truther talk radio show in New Zealand. It's called A New World Order because no country is exempt from a new world order. And speaking of applying a little bit of order, the topic of discussion today, based upon the wake of recent events here in New Zealand, which I think actually should apply internationally, because as we all know, cannabis is illegal freaking everywhere, pretty much. And essentially, whatever enforcement measures are being put forth through cost the community a hell of a lot, not only from their wallets, but also from their minds, their bodies, and their spirits as well, which incidentally get broken whenever they put them in fisticuffs in the back of a police car with protesters surrounding it. Which reminds me, Blair, we were talking about yesterday with a couple of my mates who were down at the Auckland University student protest. And these protesters surrounded this police car because the police had apprehended somebody, and they obviously didn't agree with that. So they surrounded the police car in order to prevent it from leaving. And but sure enough, a whole bunch of stormtroopers came in, pushed the crowds back, didn't arrest any of them, and simply allowed the car to migrate away. Now, I was thinking to myself, some form of tactical resistance is starting to become necessary. I watched a film called Into the Fire, made by Press for Truth last night, about the Toronto riots and the police state measures that were going on, the kettling. Do you know what kettling is? It's when they lead a whole group of protesters into a small square that's blocked off in three directions and then close in on them from the last remaining direction, stop them from being able to leave, and then gradually arrest every single one of them in that they've kettled into that little corner there, otherwise law-abiding protesters. And it seemed to me that there needs to be some form of tactics and military in nature, not offensive tactics, but escape and evade tactics, breaches of weak perimeter tactics, etc., to prevent this kind of nonsense. Like, for example, if you wanted to stop a police car from going everywhere, all you got to do is just get a whole bunch of people to climb underneath the car. That car ain't going to go anywhere because they won't be able to get you out very easily at all, okay? That's a way you can prevent a police cruiser from going out so that they won't be able to remove you until they allow the unlawfully arrested person free. Now, in the case of kettling, what they normally do is they set up a wee perimeter and they'll have usually one of the corners of the kettle will be weaker than the others. For example, in the Toronto footage that I saw, there were three lines of double-stacked police with riot shields and, you know, general police state officer uniforms and gas canisters and whatnot. And on the one side, there was a couple of police with bicycles that were blocking it with their bicycles. Now, if you were to perhaps lay on the megaphone and direct all of the protesters to rush as fast as they can towards those officers with the bicycles, push them over and get past them, and then only a few people would get arrested as opposed to all of them. I believe that to be a lawful action, considering the police are planning to unlawfully arrest you. To escape and evade tyranny is not unlawful, in my opinion, and to put yourself in harm's way in order to prevent tyranny being committed on another person is a righteous act, in my opinion.
Well, look, dissent is the foundation of democracy, and you're right about how when I was a student, you know, basically all gathering arms and basically falling to the ground and holding on to each other, you know, wrapping your legs around the person next to you and entwining arms and so forth, forming
your microphones.
Mat.
Your microphone's getting a little bit of scratching on it, Blair. Perhaps it's a little too close to your mouth.
It had fallen down. I'm sorry, just touching on my jersey. To reiterate, there was a defence in a protest that was simply to bind together to make it hard for the police to unbind you and you know, they just had to drag one or two people away. It was largely symbolic. Problem we've got now is what I call this anachronism. Sometimes they call it the search and surveillance bill, but it's actually should be termed the surveillance and search bill, because they don't search you and surveil you. They do exactly the perverse opposite. They surveil, then search you. But the linkage to protest and their ability now to gather information and then do face recognition or identify you and present a case before court now in a legitimate protest scenario is very scary for two reasons. One is the presence of police cameras or surveillance cameras on a scene actually prevents legitimate participation. People are afraid to participate. They see that there could be consequences to legitimate protest. And I think that that's a sad indictment we don't talk about when we talk about the role of the search and surveil legislation that's before the House to, you know, effectively today. So we've got this extraordinary situation where, again, failure to connect the dots is occurring. Not only is that search and surveillance bill dangerous for those reasons, it's also dangerous because when we passed the Misuse of Drugs Act, the Minister of Health, the then Honourable Tom McGuigan, pointed out, and it's in the Hansard, that that the danger of the Misuse of Drugs Act, that it would give police powers to which they're not entitled. Now, I'll say that again only because I think it deserves underlining, that the police would obtain and use powers to which they're not entitled. And when you look at the 50-odd cases currently under surveillance and the some 40-odd that they're saying before the courts at the moment, if the question was asked, how many of these are drug-related, my sense of it is... First, I would probably say 100% because that's almost likely to be the case. But because there could be an exception to that, I would probably be safe in saying that 90%. But even if it was 60 or 70% or even 50 or 30%, it still deserves part of the dialogue. This is not just about Tuhoi. This is about civil governance in our community. And we've failed with our Fourth Estate to recognise that there are harms that stem from search and surveilling. When we stepped up and knocked on somebody's door and simply smelt cannabis here in Christchurch, it resulted in the death of a police dog. If they hadn't have recognised cannabis as an offence under law, not only would those two people be still in our community contributing in whatever way they can, we'd still have a police dog alive today. The same thing could be said of Len Snee in Napier. Had that surveillance and search over simple cannabis, a non-crime by any standard, and recognised by the Law Commission in its recommendations saying that social supply should be permitted, in the sense that, you know, a transaction between two consenting adults, as we have under prostitution law and as we have under many other areas of social governance, should be at least permitted as long as there are no victims. The state has no real interest. So while the police are wanting to surveil simply because the act between consenting adults might be something that they have an interest in, that would require us to put video cameras in every bedroom. And I'm afraid to say that's an impracticality.
Well, you know what?
The voyeurism, I'm sure, he says it might be a lot of fun.
Well, the porn industry has experienced a great high at the outset from this news, I suppose. Yeah, this would be great. Sluts captured on secret police cam 5. You know, you can just imagine them. and of course, there'll be an awful lot of police officers. There'll become some description of pornography, blue uniform, revolving door of sorts. You know, that's what's going to happen when we...
The headlines would read...
Headlines, pardon the pun.
Couple have sex after 2 a.m. So
available on pay-per-view via New Zealand Police /GOVT/ dirty filthy porn that we filmed in secret.com.
Oh, that would account for the one third of the total disk space on the police computers being full of pornography.
It already does, mate.
A very funny thing happened on the campaign trail, as they often do. I was campaigning drug policy law reform over by the Westpac Stadium here. Ironically, Westpac Stadium was opened by none other than the man who introduced pot to the Beatles, Bob Dylan. The police came over to me and asked me, basically, when I say cease and desist, they had responded to a complaint from the security saying that I was talking to young people, and the security guard thought that was inappropriate. Well, the right to associate in a public space is a profoundly important right, and for people who wish to talk to me, that's up to them. If they have an objection, I'm not going to be standing there talking to somebody that doesn't want to listen. But nonetheless, this police car arrived and the police officer jumped out and he wanted to take my briefcase from me. And now, because he could see that I was wearing a Leap T-shirt with the large letters emblazoned over the back that says, cops want to legalize drugs, ask me why, he needn't have gone any further down that track. But when he wanted to take my briefcase from me, and I said to him, you can't take that from me, I've committed no offence, he said to me, it's probably full of pornography. And I said, why, are you looking for more stuff for your police computer? It stopped him in his tracks, because it had only just been revealed a couple of days before, the extent of the pornography that was there. Now, when we talk about the search and surveillance bill, I want to come back to that very point, because where the cameras in the UK are monitored by people assisting the police, these are civilian people, what was done was...
Otherwise known the colloquial term as a snitch, but go ahead.
Yep. What was done was the surveillors were surveilled by a person who then observed how much time they spent zooming in on the breasts of young girls and other such adultery.
Now, oh, so that's the answer to the question of who watches the watchers.
Yes. And so what are they doing? They've got nothing else better to do than go, oh, look at that. Oh, nice. And so that's really something that I think that we should also be considering, is who is watching the watchers and what are they doing with it? Because if I was an attractive young, elegantly dressed in current fashion and chick walking down High Street in Christchurch, I wouldn't like to think that there's some leery old guy with a camera, checking out the length of my skirt, because that's not what surveillance was ever to be put there for. And yet that's what its entertainment value to the watchers are. And if there was ever an example of how badly that conversation was being held in our community, is that there's a failure of media to understand that when the evidence shows that the police were the primary holders of the largest body of porn in one single location in this country. And that wasn't because it was evidence in any court case. This was just, oh, have you seen this, mate? And, you know, over the email it goes. And yet these very same people should dare to determine that somebody may have smoked cannabis, may have, on the premise that they smelt it. You know, that's, and that led to the shooting of the drug, of the dog Gage, that led to the tragedies at Napier, and many other police that have come under considerable duress, many of them seriously injured and others dead. The cops that were surveilling that family in South Auckland, placing a transponder unit on a vehicle. Is that not search and surveillance, or is that surveillance and search? By whichever description, it turned to custard. And it turned to custard, why? Because as a society, we're learning to trust each other less and less. Anyone interfering with my car now, all right, on my property, I would be out there and I'd be ready to give them my beans. Right?
And then it turns out that he's actually just given it a wax on and wax off as like this little Mr. Miyagi character. And, you know, I was thinking, at what point are we going to... You remember the Climate Gate emails that got released out of East Anglia University? Well, see in regarding the police stuff, I mean, I think there's going to be an incident called Prostate Gate, you know, where emails have been leaked from the... no pun intended, emails have been leaked from the central police files revealing a enormous frickin' masturbation ring that's going on inside the police at central headquarters, and they've kind of, you know, most of the files of all the pictures of the women that they've taken into custody are now slightly sticky and the file cabinets won't open kind of thing. You know, it'll be a great humbug. But
well, we shouldn't forget that police, I mean, Greg O'Connor said it rather nicely in an interview when they were talking about the search and surveillance bill, that the police are the public and the public are the police.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the darkest, scariest 2 hours in talk radio. That is incidentally hilarious. My very special guest, and I love saying that those words in a sentence, my very special guest, because, you know, it's a good lot of repetition, don't you think? That's what every radio show says. My very special guest. Yeah, but, you know, occasionally you actually do have very special guests where it's quite an apt description, like my very special guest. Blair Anderson, welcome back, bro. Now, speaking of keeping it spanking with regards to the police pornography files, I wonder, where is the real media coverage needing to be focused on with this cannabis issue? Like, if you had one aspect of the cannabis debate that you had to cover, and cover with absolute scrutiny to just wake people up out of that freaking prohibition fear mantra, porcupine brainstem kind of crap, what would it be?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and it deserves an answer that I'll give in two ways. One is the fact that this law is applied in a racist manner it is without question. We know that, you know, wherever the rules are the same, the shite is the same. In the US, here, it doesn't matter. Wherever there's people of difference, they can be targeted. And, of course, the people of difference that are targeted under the cannabis law is if you're young, male, and Maori, right, you're for it. And that's a sad indictment. And yet when you talk to the Mana Party and a number of other parties that are meant to be representing that very group of people, they don't get it. So it's racist application. And I think that tragically leaves to give license and succor to those people who are damningly hurtful in their rhetoric about this subject. And it doesn't matter whether it's the Manawatu Standard referring to Dr. Don Brash as how could I put it, as objectively as their op-ed pretends to be, right? It now refers to him as the euphemism given to him as Dr. Bong Hash. Now, that does characterize the debate in so many ways, because, you know, the classic stoner rhetoric, look, they're too lazy to even turn up at the polls. That's why the ALCP only gets a 0.5% or something.
You know what really ticked me off about that piece on John Campbell last night is the stock reel footage they have of very typical looking stoners smoking massive joints for the camera. Okay?
Yep.
They just straight up, like, in there, the second that they get an opportunity to demonize stoners, boom, they're in there. The celeb press, that narrow-minded, small, middle-class New Zealand that really loves us and keeps watching us every night and believes everything we say and hangs on every word and keeps voting for the friggin' National Party even though they're selling us down the river.
I would put that, I would say that's not John Campbell actually producing that that material behind the lines. But if they were to say, here's a bunch of stoners, we should be very cautious of. I could name a few. That guy who owns Virgin Airlines. Well, what a useless turd he turned out to be. The Prime Minister. That last one. What's her name? Ms. Clark. Well, she amounted to nothing.
She actually amounted to the third highest position in the UN because she keep progressively passing UN-based draconian legislation right here in New Zealand. So they gave her an award.
Well,
you know,
she also...
That's what you get as a former Prime Minister, I guess.
Yeah, but she also passed the... restricted substance regulations, knowing that it was her partial prohibition. I mean, anything that's age of consent orientated is a partial prohibition. The fact that we have age of consent on sex at 16 doesn't mean to say 15-year-olds aren't jumping up and down. It just means that we've sort of said, here's a bit of a line in the sand, and look, as best as we can, it gives other people some... idea of what's appropriate and what's not. But having said that, to have a R18 soft drug, use of drug policy that accepts that there is legitimate in the sense that I'm talking about here, the medicinal use, but I don't draw a boundary between medicinal and recreational use. If a medicine... is taken because you've got a leg missing, I know that that medicine isn't going to grow my leg back. But that seems to be the standard by which we hold cannabis. If it won't, repair people's brains and regrow their limbs, it can't be any good. But in actual fact, it's the fact that all the science says we should be researching this. We could, here in New Zealand, given our high usage rates, be a centre of epidemiological research in cannabinoids, not just because we grow some nice stuff up in Northland or...
I heard a rumour, Blair, that the reason why cannabis in New Zealand is the strongest in the world is because we're affected by the hole in the ozone layer, and cannabis plants grow more cannabinoid crystals on the outside of the flowering period in order to protect themselves from UV radiation. Is that true?
Well, you're partially right. In fact, the trichome, or the active part that where the THC is prevalent, has a outer layer which is spectrographically a filter that actually favours UV, not rejects it. And I say this because that the UV is actually necessary for the formation of the crucial terpenes, these flavonoids, that one of which we know is THC. There are, there's about 60-odd variants, and cannabis is a little bit like supers to a dog. A dog doesn't smell soup, it smells the ingredients. And cannabis is like that. It's a soup of different medicines that affect us in different ways. And hence the reason why the genotypes of cannabis is very important. We've just done the genome project on cannabis, very exciting in terms of because it defines the research model and it allows us now to qualify that research to a very finite degree. But the production, as you say, is dependent on UV, and that's why indoor is essentially a different plant medicinally to outdoor. The other advantage, of course, in the production of outdoor plant is you get more cannabidiol, which is a anti-anxiolytic. So you're less likely to have what I'd call the psychoactive reactive response, where it, say, flicks the manic depressive or the schizophrenic into a disillusional state. Because of that anti-anxiolytic property of CB2. The other thing that is important is, and to keep in mind is that in the Hindu Kush and all your high altitude reasons at the equatorial latitudes, the reason why pot is grown at those high latitudes is that's where your UV is highest. And that's, you know, there's your indicator of strength. So you're right about the fact that the ozone hole may contribute to strength, but the greatest contributor to strength in New Zealand is growing at altitude. Pot grown basically anything over 2,000 metres, and you see the UV band. If you do an isomer along those lines, you find that it's altitude related, and that's one of the reasons why good strong pot is not based on the size of the plant. It's more about where it's grown. And as they say, the areas in which cloudless days occur.
Hold on a second.
Denham Nelson.
If I may.
Yep.
The amount of highness you get off the plant directly corresponds to the actual highness of the plant itself in a very physical sense.
Well, not entirely, because there are areas in which there are high cloud cover. Like you could grow at altitude on the west coast and you're perpetually in cloud, whereas you could grow at a moderate altitude around, say, Wanaka or Queenstown and grow exquisite quality pot. You could grow in Northland where endless days of summer, but you grow in Southland and you get 16 hours of daylight over those short summer months. So there's a whole bunch of different biometric properties that are involved in what you'd call the end result. Genetics is probably the biggest indicator of what you're going to get, and that's why genetics is so important for the medicinal preparations that they're making, the likes of Sativex, for example, which despite popular misconception by media, Sativex is whole cannabis, effectively with the vegetative matter removed. It's still whole cannabis. It's everything that's in cannabis that's bioactive in our bodies we can possibly maintain there, ironically, suspended in alcohol. So because THC and its corollaries are lipid fats, they are dissolved in alcohol. And, you can do that with a nice bottle of whiskey. As well, the alcohol is sufficient to extract it. But you can also dissolve these in other fats like butter fat. It becomes a way of extracting the active ingredients so you can separate it from the vegetative matter. And that's why cooking cannabis becomes a harm reduction measure. That's why hashish and hash oil is a harm reduction measure. The only reason we made hashish and hash oil class B is because the police said, oh, but they can hide more of it, more secretively, and therefore they have got more evil intent, and we need to discourage that. And that was the principal argument, when in actual fact the preparation of hashish or any extract of cannabis is actually a harm reduction and harm minimization.
Not to mention a quantity minimization measure. I mean, what do you need? Like a pound of bud for an ounce of oil kind of thing? It just doesn't stack up.
Well, the thing with the likes of, say, isopropyl alcohol as an extractive measure is that if you were a clever buggy, you would actually distill it. You'd use your whiskey still out in the garage to recycle the isopropyl alcohol, and that means that you don't need strong cannabis to do that. You just need a lot of it. So you could even extract medical-grade THC from industrial or low-THC cannabis just by simply having enough of it and recycling the isopropyl alcohol. Absolutely no reason why you can't do that. In fact, for some medical preparations, that's the preferred methodology. There are better ways of doing it in a laboratory, and I've been to some of the finest laboratories in the world. Colorado State University down at Colorado Springs, where you mentioned previously, the work of Bob Malamede is done. They use what they call critical extraction, which is extracting the terpenes out at specific temperatures and pressures that allows us to actually get individual, in other words, refined cannabinoids, and that allows us to do better research. And that's how we've been able to do some of the research around Crohn's disease, which where cannabis is not only proven to be efficacious, but it's low cost. With the right seed, you can grow your own medicine. You don't need anything else. I've got a colleague.
On that note, in the news yesterday, here we are, Monsanto has patented a cannabis terminator seed.
Which is scary, because that is entirely satisfies the agenda of those people who would want to control specifically pharmaceutical grade. Now, Lester Grinspoon, the very eminent psychologist from Harvard University, speaks emphatically about this, that the medicalization of cannabis is a very, very dangerous path to go down, partly because it means that the restrictive controls would be so great that it would only give license to prohibition. He brilliantly said, if I proved to be wrong about cannabis, I would be the first to apologize. And immediately after, I would still continue to argue that prohibition is a bad way to manage the problem. So, you know, here's a guy who studied it all of his life. He wrote the book Marijuana Revisited. And it's still a greatly referenced tome on the biopsychosocial metrics of cannabis. But this represents a very, very dangerous path indeed. Where the successful models have been applied, and I've visited some of those clinics in the US of A, the successful model is actually not about cannabis at all. Cannabis is part of what they deliver and make available through their clinics, but you would best describe it as what we call a patient-centered approach, where we actually listen to the patient about what's wrong with them.
Well, by the time you get over the jet lag, you kind of have to leave New Zealand. It's true. we're pretty far out here. We are remote, but you can't say that we're isolated, though. All right? This is the thing. New Zealanders are well hooked into the rest of the world, far more so than Americans in general, mostly because there's nothing going on here. My guest today is Blair Anderson from mildgreens.blogspot.com. We've been talking about the recent, stipulations, I guess, of Dr. Don Brash talking about how he would decriminalise cannabis. The irony between right-wing, etc., and I don't believe in right-wing or left-wing. I think they're just a controlled fake paradigm to lasso everybody's votes into basically voting for somebody who's assuredly going to screw them over for the benefit of foreign banks. But there is that dichotomy, if you will, perhaps a false one, perhaps a real one, between those people who believe in civil liberties and whatnot, but also believe in violating those civil liberties for economic imperatives, you know, keeping people out of the loop with their own governance, for example, meanwhile decrying the fact that they get put in jail for absolutely no good reason with regards to cannabis. kind of seems a bit schizophrenic. And I was wondering the other day as well, somebody called me schizophrenic because they're probably crazy. And I had no idea just how much so-called schizophrenia comes about due to cannabis. According to some mainstream medical sources, approximately one quarter of people have the potential, quote, the potential of becoming schizophrenic through the usage of cannabis at least three times a day for a period of not less than 3 years. That was the margin that they came up with. Now, suffice to say, if you are doing that much weed anyway, you could conceivably have a drug problem, don't you think? And at the very least, your drug problem will be, where the heck is my next amount of weed coming from? Which will probably put a little bit of stress on you. And stress, in my opinion, is one of the main things that causes any form of what they call so-called mental illness. But of course, the prescription would be just better pot in order to get rid of your depression and psychoactivity and whatnot. Now, there's another element to this, on the other hand. It's called prohibition rage. Have you heard of this, Blair? It's basically, you're in a household, and a lot of stoners will recognize this situation. You're in a household, and you're the only stoner, okay? And you know for a fact that every time you talk about pot, you kind of get this kind of angst against you, you know, that you're buffering against this very nasty brick wall type thing. And it forces you to retreat into your room and get stoned on your own a lot and manifest a whole lot of resentment towards all those other people around you. And because you stop hanging around with them, you stop knowing how to talk to people properly. And so the next time you get social and whatnot, you might feel a little bit nervous. Or when you do talk a little bit, you sound a little bit off because you've been isolating yourself a lot. And you won't seek any help because what you're doing is illegal. And that puts a lot of extra strain on you as well because nobody's accepting me. Nobody's listening to me. And I can't talk to anybody because if I do, I'll get freaking arrested. And as a result, some people actually commit suicide or do, in fact, go crazy. That's the result of the law and people's mentality, not the result of the cannabis. Isn't that interesting? And this has happened to a number of people, quite a few, in fact. High-profile cases where people have like gone nuts or even Jim Anderton, who's a rampant prohibitionist, his daughter committed suicide jumping out her bedroom window. Didn't she?
And he put it down to pot rather than his parenting skills, and perhaps that it's easy to put a label on somebody and not face your own contribution or demons or, you know, how could I put it? I found it ironic that he should establish himself as the drug czar predicated on the fact that he'd failed as a parent, but despite his loss. And it was sad for her. You're again pointing the finger in the right direction. And perhaps I could throw a wee bit of light for listeners on this. When the Royal Society of Psychologists and Psychiatrists in London wrote about the Christchurch Health and Development Study, of which they took their principal argument that mental health issues were identified and associated with cannabis, and they said that the association was so clear that it was almost, they were inferring that it was causative, that the association was so clear. But what the association is only so clear about is nothing more than association. And it doesn't matter how much you try and say mental health is this, or cannabis specifically causes mental health problems. Here's the data that was given to the select committee that led to the phrase in their report that the mental health harms are largely overstated, and that it was this, that the risk of mental health issue is, first of all, detectable at subclinical levels. And I point this out, that there, much of the argument that they've picked up, and I've seen the figures in recent days as Don Brash's stuff has been analysed by various quarters, and it largely says things like, 10% of cannabis users go on to have mental health problems. Well, in actual fact, if you take the non-using population, one in five of us probably suffer from depression at some time in our life. So it's really hard to extract out of that data whether cannabis is causative or just correlated, or indeed if you stood around long enough, you'd find that those people that had seen mice before the age of 12 are more likely to have a mental health issue. So 10,000 non-cannabis users taking up a cannabis habit, not just an experience, not just, you know, having tried it five times and moving on, but taking up a cannabis habit at the scale that you were just talking about to prevent one mental health case occurring. So what you're suggesting is likely to be a principal cause of mental health issues. It shouldn't surprise us that John Kirwan, ironically doing very well with his Japanese rugby team, John Kirwan features on the mental health advertising that had the highest brand recognition or message recognition in New Zealand. That one series of ads with John Kirwan saying, you know, get out there and do something, get active.
They're re-airing those now.
Yes, they are. And that, you know, hope is the best cure for depression, that having a buddy and a friend who stands beside you and with you is the best indicator of good outcomes. And significantly, don't put a label on me. One of the first leading contributors to mental health conditions getting worse is putting a label on people, you know, branding them. Oh, you're just bloody nuts. Yeah, I don't want anything to do with you. Or you're a stoner. You'll amount to nothing. And just to make sure, I'll put a criminal conviction on you and tattoo it on your forehead for the rest of the world to see for the rest of your life, because that's what happens in an information society. It may as well be tattooed. It may as well be a radio chip in your, you know, inserted in your forearm.
Yeah, and it could have been something you did 20 years ago that you moved on from like a month after it happened and that kind of thing. But people don't care about what happened between these incidents and who you are today. They take that as an indication of who you are and don't actually get to know you at all. And I think that would probably cause an awful lot of frustration in the community, possibly more so than anybody else out there who thinks it's a brilliant idea to just lock people up for cannabis. But who knows? Thank you very much, Blair, for coming on the show with us today. I'm sorry. You know, I like the 2012 and Comet Ellen and, you know, conspiracy theories about we're all going to freaking die in some ball of fire or whatever. I wish we had more time.